the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we will discuss how this week New Zealand's Foreign Minister, Nanaia Mahuta, delivered a significant speech detailing how this Labour-led government in New Zealand defines its foreign policy. Now, in short, Mahuta anchored New Zealand within the Asia-Pacific region as an independent Pacific Island state with a foundation, if you want to put it, where we will engage with the outside world and with multilateralism being the thread that knits this foreign policy together. Now, if we look back over the three years since 2017, when Jacinda Ardern first became Prime Minister, to 2020, when the Labour-led government had a landslide victory, we can see incremental steps, albeit small in places, that transported this government along this foreign affairs journey. If we can define this trajectory, can we predict where it will lead? And will true independence be something that can be achieved, or will it be a problem that New Zealand is not able to deliver on? So to go through all of these questions, let's look at what the whole scope of this foreign policy announcement is, and we'll go to Paul Buchanan right now to discuss these major big issues. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Selwyn.
Yeah, tenakwe. Now, Paul, how do you read the foreign policy statements that Nanaia Mahuta addressed earlier this week?
Well, I thought it was very interesting because it was a very balanced speech. We have to realize that New Zealand straddles a fence between China and the United States. The U.S., of course, is a security partner. China is our biggest trading partner. And because they're at loggerheads and that conflict doesn't show any signs of abating, we've got to walk a very, very tight rope. And I think I've said it a few times before, but that Lee Kuan Yew remark about whether elephants are making love or fighting, the mice have to, you know, tread carefully,
or applies even here. Or even Tanifa in this case.
Again, our foreign listeners may not realize what the title of the speech means. I think I'm going to dodge it if you want to talk about it.
Yeah. No. But no, it was a quick. So, the significant elements, it's a two-pronged approach, isn't it? There's one, security elements to it, and there are trade elements to it. So we'll get into those in depth, but in general terms, and you know, how do you think that the balance was right between those two issues?
Oh, yes, I do. I think that it's interesting, and again, we'll have time to develop this theme, but you know, if anyone knows anything about New Zealand foreign policy history, you know that as of the mid-80s, with our declaration of the non-nuclear status, there was a period of estrangement, particularly with the United States, but with other Western countries. And then as of 9/11, the fifth Labour government worked very hard to reestablish its relationship, particularly with the United States, in the intelligence field, in the military field, and that sort of thing. And it may be that they tipped the scales a little too far in favor of this Western-centric security approach. And so now there seems to be a recalibration, and they're coming back a little bit towards the middle. They're not abandoning the Western-centric security approach. I mean, not at all. But what she's signaling is that we're not going to be led by the nose, even though we're small. And then on the other hand, she's telling the Chinese that we recognize that our undue dependence on China for trade gives them disproportionate economic leverage over us. And so we need to diversify, for political as well as economic reasons. So it seemed to me that it was a very well-crafted speech and that the cool heads in other capitals, to include Beijing, will fully understand it for what it's meant to be.
Well, let's just have a look here. Look, I agree with those points as well, Paul, from the point of view. I think there was nuance in there. There was cultural expression. I think she got the balance right. The foreign policy positioning of New Zealand, it seems to be where the expectation of those that take notice of these kind of things would like New Zealand to be positioning, most people. But looking around, the reportage and the analysis that has gone on in the wake of the speech this week, just noting on politic, for example, I won't bring it up on screen, this one, because it is behind a paywall and disrespecting Richard Harman's work there. But highly respected political journalist Richard Harman, he wrote, and I'll quote here his piece, but what was clear in the speech by Naya Mahuta was that if New Zealand did have something to say to China, it would not say it as part of the Five Eyes group. So that's what you were talking about there. And then he goes on further, what Naya Mahuta is saying here, and she says, and I quote, "Let me be really clear." This is Naya Mahuta. "New Zealand has been obvious, certainly in this term and since we've held the portfolio, not to invoke the Five Eyes as the first point of contact on messaging out on a range of issues that really exists outside the remit of the Five Eyes." And she just finishes off here. "So we've not favoured that type of approach and have expressed it to Five Eyes partners," meaning she's expressed New Zealand's views ahead of the speech, as you would expect her to do. By remit, Richard Harman says, he presumably means Five Eyes' role as an intelligence-sharing organisation. So I think he anchored the main points from the security point of view. But let's just go and have a look at One News and what One News was, how it was reporting it here, Paul. And I'll just kick this off.
What I'm looking at is to ensure that we see China within the context of our long-term economic recovery and resilience. And for that to occur, we do have to have a diversity within the market, the markets that we seek opportunity from and through our trade agreements. And it's important right now to ensure that as we recover from COVID again, which is a major disruptor, we are taking that approach going forward, and that businesses are very aware of the need to build resilience, both for economics, but actually for social well-being as well.
So, Minister, are you saying that the current level of trade with China is not in New Zealand, it is not in New Zealand's long-term interest for it to be sustained at that particular level?
I'm saying that being reliant on any one market puts us in a very difficult position, and the long-term resilience for New Zealand businesses and traders and exporters is to look to the diversity of relationships, yes, across the region and further afield, to be able to buffer some of what consequentially may be a negative impact. We've seen COVID as a major disruptor. There is no guarantees about what the future holds. So the more resilient our market is, our economy is, then the better it is for New Zealanders.
So, Paul, Naya Mahuta there, the New Zealand Minister of Foreign Affairs. So you can see how she's addressed both issues there. She's addressed the issues of trade in the latter part of that response, and also the security elements. Let's get into the security elements first, Paul. I'd like to hear if what you think in deeper levels here from the point of view of political science and also analysis. And also from How do you believe this element on security will be received by one, China, and also by the significant partners in the Five Eyes, namely the United States, Britain, Canada, and Australia, our other partners in the Five Eyes? How do you see this being received by them?
Thanks for allowing me to expand a little bit on the security side. Let's start with two backdrop conditions. New Zealand is a member of the Five Eyes Signals Intelligence Network. It is the smallest and the most economically vulnerable of those countries. The other countries are, in fact, far more resilient when it comes to their economy. So let's keep that as factor number one. Factor number two is that during the Trump administration, the Trump White House tried to get pressure allies to genuflect to Donald Trump's whim, one of which was to signal to China in every possible forum that it would be resisted and challenged. And he pressured European allies, he pressured international organizations. And one of the things he did was to use the Five Eyes network in order to signal diplomatically to to the Chinese displeasure about the de facto annexation of Hong Kong and the treatment of the Uyghurs.
Yeah.
And so that, those are the background conditions. During the first labor-led government from 2017 to 2020, the foreign and defense ministers were New Zealand first ministers, more conservative than the laborites, and very pro-US. Yeah. So they went along with Trump's pressure. And New Zealand signed on to a Five Eyes statement condemning the Chinese for what it was doing in Hong Kong. The Chinese responded very bluntly to New Zealand, saying that it would get its eyes poked out if it kept on sticking its face into Chinese business. Mm. There was another statement right early on in Mahuta's tenure, when she was still getting her feet on the ground, that followed up on that. And again, the Chinese responded very strongly. So that's the backdrop. But let's be very clear about this. And this is why there is balance here. The Five Eyes is a signals collection and signals intelligence collection and sharing network.
That's the remit she talks about.
That's the original charter. Okay. Mm. So signals collection and intelligence sharing. It is not a diplomatic coalition. It is not a military security alliance. It is supposed to be in the shadows. It should not, under any circumstances, be used for diplomatic signaling. You have diplomats for that. I personally don't think that spies make a very good first line when it comes to diplomatic posturing.
And we did a major program on this at the time, didn't we? Back there in November, around that time last year in 2020, where we absolutely addressed this thing, discussed all of the traps that joining the Five Eyes on diplomatic kind of communiques, and where that would lead for a small country like New Zealand. So what we're seeing here is Nanaia Mahuta, now she's got her legs under the desk, and has actually got her portfolio wrapped firmly in her grasp, demonstrating some common sense and also will and taking New Zealand foreign policy forward in a net Pacific independent state kind of way than we've seen in over a decade.
Well, what you see internally is she's wrestling the portfolio from the death grip that Winston Peters had on it for 3+ years. And again, let's be very clear. It's an intelligence network. When you offer diplomatic commentary about certain subjects, you are signaling the target of your interest. I mean, again, it was absurd on the face of it that Winston Peters went along with the Trump pressure. It was absolutely absurd to do it. The bigger Five Eyes partners could indulge him, but we cannot afford to place ourselves in the target hairs of a country such as China that can retaliate against us. And quite frankly, none of our partners are going to come and help us if we are hit by economic reprisals. So the move to go back to the original remit, the original charter of the Five Eyes, I think is a wise one. Time to go back into the shadows and do intelligence work. We have plenty of diplomats. And she said, she went on and she said, we would prefer to engage other multilateral channels with like-minded countries. So put the emphasis on values, not security. She talked specifically about the Australians, and New Zealand and Australia have signed various bilateral statements. So to me, it was a fresh dose of common sense after the somewhat fawning approach of the Peters foreign policy towards the United States. I mean, again, we're indulging Trump, who was a very ignorant individual in a position of global leadership. And now that he's gone, and this gets to the second part of your question, I don't think our allies are going to be bothered in the least. The Biden administration will fully understand our position. The State Department is now led by a super experienced diplomat, Anthony Blinken.
Yep.
He's going to fully understand why we needed to do this. And what he got was a bonus in that then Mahuta talked about diversifying our trade relationship so that we're no longer overtly, she didn't mention China by name, but she was talking to the China Council, you know, basically saying we've got to diversify for a variety of reasons. And on those grounds, I thought she hit the right tone of balance without offending anybody, because I can assure you that in the intelligence business, no one's going to get their panties in a wedge over her statements. In fact, no. I would be willing to bet that the operators would prefer to get out of the way and go about the business of collecting and sharing signals intelligence and not be put out in front as some sort of diplomatic coalition against the Chinese. Because let's be clear, the only statements that the Five Eyes have made in a diplomatic way have been adversarial to the Chinese. They're not giving anyone else the treatment.
And so it's using it as a means to communicate issues of U.S. foreign policy and what and its advantages that it detects. But if you look at what Nanaia Mahuta has done here and where she's positioned, and I pick up those points and I agree wholeheartedly that she hasn't offended anyone, but it is also a case here where, while not offending anyone, she has well and truly established New Zealand's position as an independent Pacific Island state in the process. And ironically, the foreign minister that preceded her, Winston Peters, came from the party, more conservative, as you had identified, called New Zealand First. But it's Nanaia Mahuta's policy that has actually placed New Zealand first in foreign policy terms in this regard. And I think that's why there's a major response through New Zealand in favourable terms about where her positioning lies.
Yeah, and look, I think we need to give credit to her senior diplomats for this speech. You know, I think that she deserves credit, of course, but her senior team obviously crafted this. And what I find really delicious about it is that it makes it very hard for the Chinese to respond with any retaliatory gesture. Because when she talked about trade and diversifying trade, she talked on economic terms with the implicit thrust being we need to get out from under the Chinese, because the leverage being exerted on us in the event of some sort of diplomatic bust-up is too great. And I'll tell you, there's a common sense approach here. I happen to be the father of a 7-year-old, and that 7-year-old has a keen interest in Legos. Right now, there is a Lego shortage around the world, as well as a toy shortage in general. Why? Because all toy commodity chains end up in China. All production is in China. And China has been slowed down by the COVID virus. And so there are no Legos to be found. There's a black market in Legos.
Whoa. Who would have thought?
In fact, just 2 weeks ago, there was a raid on a German toy store where organized crime sent in a bunch of criminals. They bust in, and the only thing they stole were Legos. They cleaned the place out. So my point is there's a lot of economic sense in what she has to say.
Yeah.
And so she's covered herself with the trade logic, and then implicit is the political diplomatic logic of we got to get out from under the Chinese thumb. So everybody who's in the game will fully understand what she's saying, why she's saying it, and the fact that she balanced it and said it in an extremely polite way. So I don't see the Chinese coming back to bark at her. I don't see the Americans or other Five Eyes partners coming back to bark. In fact, I think the experienced people in the capitals will go, you know, that was a good way of straddling the fence.
Mm. If we just have a quick look at, once again, right on this thing that you're talking about, this issue, this element of this issue that you're talking about. Radio New Zealand here earlier this week, New Zealand concerned about China asserting itself in the region, the foreign minister says. And what she's saying there, and they've obviously packaged it in a hard way, although there's been no official Chinese response to this, which indicates that they do understand. I agree with you, Paul. I think that the Chinese see mutual interest in this. They're talking about, you know, with respect to the Pacific, the Chinese investments that have been in the Pacific, but more so the development that has occurred with Chinese money and where Pacific Island states, or Pacific economies in particular, the Polynesian side of the Pacific, have become indebted to China. Nanaia Mahuta addressed this specifically in her reportage, didn't she? And it'll be, what do you make of that particular element of Polynesian investment and Polynesian economies becoming vulnerable, particularly in this the grip of COVID and the wake of the COVID pandemic?
Well, it turns out, and it's an extremely interesting subject, because the Chinese appear to have been moved through three phases of their approach to third world countries in general, the South Pacific in particular. And that is, the first phase was the phase of so-called checkbook diplomacy. So the Chinese opened their checkbooks. They funded the building of schoolhouses and sports stadiums and that sort of thing as gestures of goodwill. The reckoning by a lot of seasoned observers is that they also lined the pockets of elites throughout the region. But anyway, they used their checkbook. Then that morphed under the Belt and Road Initiative into what is now known as debt diplomacy. Hmm. You get these countries into a serious amount of debt, and then you ask for favors, or you ask for paybacks that are not necessarily in kind, may not be monetary. They could be diplomatic. They could be strategic. I mean, a number of things. So, and that's now the phase we're in. There is suspicion that we're about to move into what you might call humanitarian diplomacy centered around COVID pandemic relief, that the Chinese will flood the region with cheap vaccines, that sort of thing, in order to curry favor with besieged elites who are not handling the pandemic very well. There's good news and bad news there. Most of the Pacific is handling the pandemic pretty well, the exception being Tahiti and Fiji, which has now had its third wave. And so they may have some leverage there. But that is, you know, New Zealand, for example, is well aware of how COVID relief or mitigation can be used for strategic purposes. And so I think that what New Zealand is doing is positioning itself so that if there are any moves by the Chinese to move into this next stage, that we will have the ability to offer alternatives, perhaps, you know, entirely for free to neighboring countries in order to relieve their I'm not saying for certain, because I don't know for certain, but my understanding is that New Zealand has bought enough vaccines, not only for its home population, but for the populations of Tonga, Samoa, and even Fiji, and is willing to release those vaccines as a goodwill solidarity gesture. Yeah, if it does that,
as a regional partner. Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister, addressed that about a month ago, where she spoke specifically that negotiations are going on with the Pacific Island states with respect to what vaccine they prefer. Like we know, some of the vaccines have been found to be more safer than others. Others, you know, don't travel well or don't store well. What's the infrastructure of which the various islands have? So what vaccine actually matches the requirement and all of those boxes. So New Zealand, yes, is well advanced, as we understand it, in being able to assist in the vaccination programs in the Pacific itself, particularly those realm countries. If we look at Niue, you look at the Cooks, Tokelau, etc., but also, as we understand it, the bigger economies like Samoa, Tonga, and certainly Fiji if it needs assistance there. So there's interesting things. If we just basically look at and pick up a point here too, this is on Foreign Affairs site here, and it's just announcing that came through a couple of days ago that the Australian Foreign Minister is to visit Aotearoa, New Zealand. That was announced by the New Zealand government. That actual visit of the foreign minister, it's a bilateral, if you like, that comes around as per course. That is with Nanaia Mahuta as foreign minister. The two will exchange, and Nanaia Mahuta ahead of that that meeting announced that certainly Australia and its relationship with China will be at the forefront, and obviously New Zealand's foreign policy speech, of which was pushed only this week. So also just hitting on the other headlines with respect to New Zealand's multilateral commitments, of which was a big part of Nanaia Mahuta's speech, that New Zealand's foreign policy would be basically independent, but the thread holding that independence together was through multilateral forums, and where it has something to say perhaps on foreign policy grounds, on moralistic grounds, on ethical grounds about the human rights alleged abuses in various countries, it will do so through multilateral challenges channels and pick up those. Now, New Zealand also, you know, showing that UN Security Council, obviously a multilateral group, the United Nations, the Security Council manoeuvres around the Korean Peninsula, surveillance manoeuvres that are going on. New Zealand announced this week, only 2 days ago, it's sending Air Force aircraft up there to maintain a vigilance, if you like, and surveillance thing. So New Zealand's independence, or why I'm addressing those things, Paul, is not to be read as neutral, which is a clearly different thing. New Zealand believes that it engages through the multilateral elements that are available to it, and those things that it's announced this week are showing that this is what it's talking about. So not neutrality where it doesn't engage with the rest of the world. It is independent and voicing things in its own right in such ways. So, Paul, if we look at the trade elements, and certainly with Australia, the Foreign Minister is right here in New Zealand. The Australian Foreign Minister is in New Zealand right now at the moment, in talks with Nanaia Mahuta and the New Zealand government in general. Where do you see Australia's position with respect to New Zealand? How does it view our renewed status as independence? And I just shadow paraphrase a little bit that back in the 1980s, when David Lange was the Prime Minister and New Zealand embarked on independence with respect to its anti-nuclear stance and was expelled from ANZUS, Australia was very, very antagonistic toward New Zealand, and that took some time to heal. So how do you think it will respond to New Zealand right now in this situation?
Well, I think it'll respond diplomatically. It's the prerogative of the host country to frame the discussions. So that was another thing that was embodied in this speech, is that Mahuta was basically framing some aspects of the discussion, and the Australians, you know, will simply have to live with that framing. And so I think that there won't be major disagreements coming out. There can't be. I mean, the fact is that we may approach particularly the subject of China in different ways. You know, New Zealand does so not because it doesn't think the Australians know what they're doing. It's just that we're more strategically vulnerable. And so we have to be a little more polite, a little more diplomatic, and we can learn from the Australians all the wrong lessons. Because let's think about it. Australia has been slapped around by the Chinese on trade issues and whatnot, for it's speaking up very forcefully about things like the Uyghurs. We share the values that the Australians have, no doubt about it. And that's where I think it gets interesting about the multilateralism. I'll point out this. Although the language of diplomacy is very opaque and almost riddle-like in its nuance and subterfuge, it actually is the distillment, if you will, of age-old commonalities of human beings. Multilateralism is another way of saying strength through numbers. It's as simple as that. And so New Zealand prefers a strength through numbers approach because it's the small guy in that crowd.
Absolutely.
And it feels like it defends other small guys, smaller nations, like the Pacific Island community. Incidentally, for the foreign listeners, countries of the realm are countries, semi-autonomous states that fall under New Zealand jurisdiction. That's different from the fully independent states that we have, like Fiji, Tonga, and Samoa. And so when Selwyn mentioned countries of the realm, let's say the Cook Islands, is still a semi-autonomous dependency of New Zealand, and so we cover them as a matter of principle. Again, we're connected to them, share currencies, that sort of thing. But getting back to the bigger picture, You said it absolutely right. There is a concept known as principled neutrality, in which countries try to be neutral in the disputes of others. And I certainly think in principle, that's a really great principle. On the other hand, again, getting back to the basics of humanity, the world is full of pushing and shoving. And sometimes when the big guy is set to pushing and shoving, it's very hard to remain neutral, particularly when your value system, which gets emphasized again and again now in this government's foreign policy pronouncements, when your value system is clearly aligned with one of the contending parties in a great power dispute, whether or not that dispute involves surrogates, let's say, like North Korea, you're going to abandon neutrality, stand on principles of independence, but choose a side. And so us sending surveillance aircraft to the Korean Peninsula will undoubtedly annoy the Chinese. Their client state is the target of that surveillance. But there's not much they can do about it when it's under UN mandate. I mean, if they go after New Zealand disproportionate to the fact that we send one of our precious maritime surveillance aircraft up there, then they appear unreasonable. And they may not be worried about appearances over the short term, but the accumulation of responding to perceived slights out of proportion to the significance of the slight is cumulative and will be detrimental to the Chinese over the long term. So,
and I'll just pick up on that point too, is that this is part of the multilateral United Nations efforts, the Security Council, of which China is a part of the Security Council, may or may not have agreed with the surveillance elements of it. But it would understand that New Zealand is taking part under that umbrella and within that coordination by United Nations teams. That is quite different for should New Zealand have attached itself to the Quad Defence Pact that the United States, Australia, Japan and others, India in this case, is it correct? And their manoeuvres in around this Southeast Asia and the South China Sea. So New Zealand is saying and obviously indicating here by way of announcement that yes, we will be active in this United Nations multilateral efforts up there around the Korean Peninsula for this purpose. But it's hands off way in the distance, a long way away from that Quad. Paul, I'd be really interested to see what you think of the nuance of that messaging, but also the realities from a security point of view as well.
Well, you actually captured the difference very well. The issue is this, and now we're into the subject of military diplomacy. And military diplomacy, contrary to what some people may think, can be very subtle. It doesn't necessarily have to involve massing, you know, uniforms and guns. Everybody knows, and I say by everybody in the UN Security Council, all our major allies and what have you know, that for us to send a P-3 aircraft to the Korean Peninsula for an extended period of time is a tremendous cost to New Zealand. It's an expenditure of resources that takes away from protection of our own exclusive economic zone and that sort of thing. They know that. And so they see us committing nevertheless. That will win us a lot of favors as a good global citizen. And we're not shooting at anybody. In fact, the surveillance is to prevent or at least detect early warning anything the North Koreans might do by way of shooting at anything. So that's subtle. It signals to people that we're in spite of the cost to us, doing what we can in an internationally recognized threat. Now, the Quad is basically a case of fence-ringing the Chinese. It's directed at China. Its policy statements, the threat is China. It sees it as an adversary. And New Zealand, again, because of its unique stature, is not in a position to get involved with a ring-fencing exercise on the Chinese when it has other avenues in which to show its resolve. Remember, we have sent Navy frigates to be part of the freedom of navigation exercises in the South China Sea. And that's earned us some serious warnings from the Chinese because the Chinese are trying to play divide and conquer. the approach that is being being signaled here, but signaled in a real way, does not allow the Chinese to play divide and conquer with New Zealand. You know, we're simply not doing the type of things that they could readily then say, you're going to be punished for this. Again, the whole approach is I think, so good that it actually makes it much more difficult for retaliation on any level. And so the signaling that's going on here, I think, is rather adroit, to be honest with you. And you know, Selwyn, that I was pretty skeptical about this new foreign policy team. So I can say with some relief that they've more than exceeded my expectations with this speech. The question is, can they continue this and maintain this relative independence? That's what I would call it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not fully independent because we simply cannot be, right? We're too dependent on trade. We're too dependent on the goodwill of others.
And as I put in the introduction to this, this is too serious to actually fail on. So this independence positioning, you can't step out into this space and then not follow through. So do you see that it is an achievable goal? And, do you see it as an achievable goal? And what is the consequence of that?
Well, I think that we have to be very pragmatic. I think that when we talk about relative independence, we talk not only about the fact that, you know, we have dependencies, we're dependent on many things, international, but also that our independence needs to be conditioned. It needs to be contingent on other actors playing their part. I mean, if the United States comes and says, if you don't do this, that, or the other, we're going to eject you from the Five Eyes. At that point, I personally think that, well, then kick us out. We'll find other partners. We won't be made to bend that way. And likewise for the Chinese. I mean, I'm trying to play the role of independent here. And so I think that if we understand that independence is conditioned on, the global conditions around us, and if we understand that it's relative to the power of others and what they may or may not, their relationships are with us and what they may expect of us, then absolutely, yes, I think we can pursue this over time, constantly reviewing where we are. Mm. And if we play our cards the way this speech outlined them, I think it'll be very hard for any great power to get annoyed with New Zealand to the point that they would want to hurt it economically or otherwise. So, I applaud the speech for its initiative. Now I simply want to see it followed up. And the big pressures, quite frankly, I think the Chinese will read this for what it is. I have seen some very unpleasant commentary in the UK press and in the Australian press about New Zealand bending over to the Chinese and kissing the ring. And quite frankly, that's the pressure we're going to get. Yeah. And I would simply treat it as water off a duck's back.
Yeah. Yeah, don't even have to engage with it in a sense, just address it for what it is. And well done for raising that. Paul, in closing, and this may be a program that we follow through with perhaps next week, it would be quite good if we did so. If we were looking at New Zealand and its repositioning, and remember within Nanaia Mahuta's speech, she addressed issues relating to concerns of the Polynesian side of the Pacific in particular. Remember that Nanaia Mahuta, as we said at the front end of this program, she comes from a Māori background. You can see that she's wearing the moko on her chin. You can see that the tone of her speech was founded in Māori culture, the references to mythological thinking and feeling was right at the forefront. That seems as much that she was communicating clearly to the Chinese there, which I thought in many respects was a clever communication. But it's also speaking a language of which one would believe the Pacific can embrace too. And this is a shift for New Zealand. that while we've been involved with the Pacific, it is some years ago, perhaps going back 20 years, since New Zealand was a significant small power partner with Polynesian states. Do you see that this is going to be responded to in kind by the Pacific states, the Polynesian economies? And how do you think that's going to shape throughout the 2021, perhaps leading up to the Pacific Island forums in the latter part of this year?
Well, I think it's an interesting posturing for the shared mythologies that Polynesian nations again share because of their common ancestors and that sort of thing. I think that it also harks to what is known as the foundational myth. You know, most great countries have what is known as a foundational myth. Some of it's grounded in reality. Most of it is grounded in the imagination. But it's about the circumstances by which a community, a political community, came together. And there are a lot of commonalities in the South Pacific on the circumstances by which these island states arose, to include New Zealand, you know, the founders of these societies. And she can appeal to that, and she can appeal to it at a very important juncture in South Pacific politics, because we appear to be seeing the transition from old autocratic ways of being. You know, many, again, of the foreign listeners may not realize that there is royalty in the islands. There's a monarchy that runs Tonga, and they are the power structures. But that's changing. We've just had a rather dramatic election in Samoa, which is still deadlocked. And that was unimaginable even 10 years ago, much less 30 or 40 years ago. Fiji, of course, is a post-authoritarian state. And so we've got a lot of those, you know, so-called transitional dynamics at play. And she has situated herself, you know, again, with this speech, as a honest interlocutor in some of those dynamics, not all of them. Obviously, self-determination is the ultimate determinant of a nation's fate. But New Zealand, by coming out this way, knowing that these island states are being pressured by the Chinese on the one hand, and then pressured by their traditional Western masters, I'd hate to say it, these weren't partners, these were masters, on the other hand, I think puts New Zealand in a very good diplomatic position, not only bilaterally with each state, but as a regional representative in organizations like the UN. So again, kudos to her and her team for doing this at a moment where they clearly have recognized that the landscape, or if you will, the seascape in the South Pacific is beginning to change.
On that point, Paul, thank you for your company again today. And thank you to those that have joined us in a live capacity or even on demand with this podcast. We'll be back again on Thursday around midday New Zealand time, which is around about 7 p.m. on Eastern Standard Time in the United States. And that's a Wednesday, of course, over there. But we look forward to your company again next week. And as always, until that time, take care. And we'll see you later, as we say here in New Zealand.